Around the 1st of August, one of Ernie Bozart's colleagues at the Mississippi Valley Archaeology Center, Kathy Stevenson, discovered the vandalization in Larson Cave. She was leading a group of teachers into the cave at the time. It's located near Eastman in the rugged country above the lower Kickapoo Valley, and it's the second vandalization in Wisconsin in less than 3 years, despite a state law that makes damaging such sites a felony. We'll be talking about that now with Ernie Bozart. Ernie is regional archaeologist with the Mississippi Valley Archaeology Center at UW-La Crosse. He's the author of a book on deep cave rock art sites in Wisconsin. It's called Deep Cave Rock Art in the Upper Mississippi Valley. It's published by Prairie Smoke Press. Ernie and Jim Thieler have also published a book called 12 Millennia, The Archaeology of Wisconsin's Driftless Area. And we're pleased to welcome him to the phones, although not under the best of circumstances. Ernie, hi. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Larry. Glad to be here.
It's really tough to find vandalism like that on such wonderful pieces of art.
Oh, it's extremely frustrating. Most of the caves that we go into and rock shelters that we go into where we find rock art have graffiti on the walls for the past 150 years or so. So it's not surprising to find the rock art already damaged and to some degree before we encounter them and then document them and then try to work for their preservation. But it's very frustrating when you go through that process and you start to work with the landowners, because most of these sites are on private property, to get a stewardship going. And then to come in and after several years and see that somebody has just gone in and snuck in and carved their names right over a 1,000-year-old painting.
Yeah, what was the damage discovered there in Larson Cave? I think it was initials, wasn't it, or something?
That's right. It was the paintings in Larson Cave are somewhat difficult to see, these were two red paintings. One was of a bird, probably a thunderbird rendition, and the other one was just of a human arm all by itself, both red painted, and both of those had initials carved right over the top of them and gouged into the pigments. So.
Why do people do that?
I don't know. It's a good question. I it's probably that most of the time it's probably not malicious. It's probably younger people on an adventure going in, and they see all the other names and the graffiti on the walls, and they're just adding their names. And quite honestly, if you don't have a good eye for rock art, it's not that obvious sometimes, and they probably just don't see it, and they're just adding their names onto the wall as well. The other extreme is when it is intentional and it is malicious, and there's a site in southern Wisconsin called the Gottschall Rock Shelter, where in the early 1980s somebody went in with a mason saw and tried to literally saw one of the paintings in that cave off the wall, presumably to sell it on the market, in the antiquities market. And that's even more frustrating and disappointing. And that's what prompted, in fact, the state to pass the law making these things a criminal act and a felony and a penalty. But it's hard to catch people out in these rural areas doing it.
Yeah, and it's a fairly stiff penalty, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm not a lawyer, but I think it's a felony with some time and up to a $10,000 fine, if I remember.
3.5 years in prison.
3.5 years, thank you.
And has anyone been prosecuted for violating that law?
No, not to date. There's three known examples that have been documented. One is the Gottschall Rock Shelter and now Larson Cave. The other one is at Rocha Cree State Park near Adams Friendship in Adams County in the central part of the state, where that's the only publicly accessible rock art site in Wisconsin. And we've tried to steer people to that site to view rock art. Because we're one of the protective measures in the rural areas is just to not tell people where they're at, because it just takes one individual to go in there and ruin it for everyone. But at Rocha Cree, it was a publicly accessible and DNR managed, and there was interpretive signs, and somebody went there in there about 2.5 years ago now. And with spray painted their names right over the main part of the carving panel there too. So,
and that can't be really repaired, can it?
Boy, it's difficult. They did an attempt at Rochacree, the DNR, along with a number of people who donated funds to bring in a conservator, literally a rock art conservator, to try to remove the spray paint from the sandstone that it was applied to, and they removed probably 80% of it. So when you go there now, there's a shadow of the spray painted name written over the top that you can see, but it's pretty faint. It's not like it used to be. So, carvings on the other hand are almost impossible to restore. When you cut your name through an old painting, I don't know what you do with that.
Yeah, I've often wondered, and I'm sure you've given it some thought. I often wondered, could we put some sort of plate glass over the top of this?
Right. It's a possibility. There's all sorts of techniques that need to be looked at. The problem probably with plate glass over the top is that you create a microenvironment that might trap moisture and cause the natural deterioration of it. So one of the things we try to do in cave settings is to just is to keep the natural airflow and things stabilized. If you change the environment, then the rock art begins to deteriorate.
Yeah.
There is one successful example, a site called Tainter Cave, which is the other cave that's described in the book Deep Cave Rock Art, where we found over 100 paintings in this cave, a sandstone cave. And in that case, we put up, working with cave conservation people, we put up a steel gate at the entrance to literally prevent people from going in. That opening was relatively small, about 3 feet high by 20 feet across. So installing the gate, while it wasn't easy, it was manageable. The Larson Cave entrance is 20 feet tall and 50 feet across, and it's just to do that would be an enormous expense and labor.
Yeah, I can certainly understand that. Why were most of those paintings and drawings we haven't done? I assume we have no real idea. It's art and.
I mean, why did the Native Americans
right.
do the paintings?
Yeah, to go back to that.
Well, that's a good. that's one of the things we're all trying to figure out. The rock art, is the paint. Well, boy, there's two issues with rock art for archaeologists. One is it's very difficult to find out how old it is to date the rock art. We can do carbon-14 dating on organic materials, but rock isn't organic, and so it's almost impossible to date rock art. So we don't know how old it is, and therefore we oftentimes don't know which archaeological culture we can attribute the paintings to, whether it's Paleo-Indian, the first people coming in 12,000 years ago, or people who lived here during the Effigy Mound period 1,000 years ago. It's very difficult to apply to assign the rock art to individual cultures, and that hinders our ability to then try to decipher meaning, and that's the other problem with rock art, is understanding what exactly it means. There are symbols that we can clearly recognize. There's human beings, there's birds, there's buffalo, there's deer, and then there's probably 80% of it is just abstract symbols that we just don't know what they mean. The working with Native Americans and oral tradition and things it gives us the ability to try to decipher stories that may have carried through the oral tradition for hundreds or thousands of years, and the Gotchall Shelter is a great example of that, where there's a panel that probably represents a story that was recorded for the first time in 1913, but that painting goes back 1,000 years. It's the Red Horn Legend. It's difficult to understand the meaning. It's difficult to date it. Why it was done, presumably, the Native Americans who drew the art, who created the art, are recalling stories, or they're doing ritual activities that touches the spirits, connects to the spirits, gives them hunting magic, things like that. But we just don't know for sure.
Well, let's give our listeners a chance to join in. If you'd like to visit with us, give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And let's go to Mary in Madison. Mary, hi. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Yes, I was wondering, I assume that you're talking about the woodland culture. And I was wondering, what characteristics distinguish the woodland culture from the Mississippian culture?
Okay. Great question. The woodland culture is dates from approximately the time of Christ until about 1000 A.D., and the characteristics for woodland are the beginnings of pottery, so we find ceramic vessels made for the first time beginning around about 500 B.C. or so, and they last throughout the pre-European era. And the woodland pottery tends to be clay mixed with crushed rock or granite. We call it grit tempering. So it's a distinctive kind of pottery. And then the woodland people also made mounds. They're the people who made the Hopewell mounds and then the animal-shaped effigy mounds. Those are both woodland cultures. Mississippian is a culture that comes in around 1,000 years ago, around 1,000 A.D., towards the end of the woodland culture, at least in southern Wisconsin. In Mississippian culture, the pottery is tempered with crushed clamshell, so it's very distinctive from the woodland pottery. Mississippian towns like Aztalan between Madison and Milwaukee have mounds, but they're not animal-shaped mounds, and they're not the conical-shaped or dome-shaped mounds like Hopewell. Mississippian mounds typically are rectangular and flat-topped, and the purpose of Mississippian mounds is not just to bury the dead in, but oftentimes to put a structure on top. So a little bit different. Mississippians are corn farmers, and woodland people tend to be hunters and gatherers.
Thanks very much for calling, Mary. Appreciate it. Let's give Nick a chance in Green Bay now. Nick, hello to you.
Hi. I was sent when I was 17 because I was kind of a troublemaker as a kid.
Yeah.
And I went to a school called Outward Bound in the Boundary Waters.
Uh-huh.
And the people that the cultures that had us there, we were in canoes, and they took us to this one spot. We were in canoes, and we looked up, and there's all these really cool art paintings up there from the Indians when
right. The
Ice Age was there, and that was just, like, the coolest thing.
Right.
It was just impressive.
Can you tell us a little about those early Bozarts?
A little bit. The Boundary Waters is one area in the Midwest where there's a lot of rock exposure, and there's lots of red paintings scattered throughout the Boundary Waters. And if you know where they're at, you can see them if you visit up there. Some of them are fairly faded, but others are pretty clear to see. Tend to be moose and canoes and things like that. In Wisconsin, most of the rock art is in the unglaciated driftless area in the southern southwestern portion of the state, and that's largely just because that's where we have rock exposures. Probably 90% of the rock art in Wisconsin is in the driftless area. Then if you get into Illinois and Iowa, there's almost no rock art. Until you get down to the Ozarks in the Missouri area where you get rock exposures again and you start to see a fair amount of rock art again. So rock art is not evenly distributed across the landscape. It tends to occur where there's rock exposures, and Boundary Waters is just one of those areas where it's up there. So hopefully as a 17-year-old who could have been one of those people who damaged rock art, that experience gave you an appreciation for it so that you would, you would never think of doing that and spread that word.
It gave me an awesome appreciation for it to know that it was there for thousands of years. And these kids that are damaging it, it's just ridiculous. There's no reason for it.
Yeah, it's almost certainly just an unawareness of it. So education has got to be a key component in doing future preservation. We've got to get to those people and inform them that this stuff exists and it's not appropriate to be writing your name on cave walls, even though people did it before us.
Is there anything in the schools, Ernie, in those areas where we have significant rock art?
A little bit. If you talk to teachers, they're swamped with what they already have to teach, and with the standards today, it's hard to get new things in. But Act 31, requires us to teach Native American heritage to some degree within the school curriculum, and what do you teach within that portion? What part of the Native American heritage do we try to teach in Act 31? It's so extensive, it's so diverse, it's so broad that rock art is, if it was included, it'd be a small segment of it, but it needs to be brought in and mentioned as part of that program, sure.
Yeah. Thanks, Nick, for calling. Appreciate it. Ernie Bozart, our guest today, regional architect with the Mississippi Valley Archaeology Center, author of Deep Cave Rock Art. And we're talking about the vandalization of Native American rock art at Larson Cave in southwestern Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about Native American rock art today with Ernie Bozart, regional archaeologist. Glad to have him listening in. Certainly, if you want to join in with your own questions or comments, give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or in Madison, you can reach us at 263-1890 and email us at talk@wpr.org. And let's go to Dick in Waukesha next. Dick, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I tuned in when kind of in the middle of the discussion about how difficult or impossible it is to age the paintings because you can't age rock. But is it possible to tease away a little bit of the paint, a microscopic particle, and analyze it? And maybe you've already talked about that, and I missed it.
No, yep. We haven't talked about that. Go ahead, Ernie.
Right. Well, great question, Dick. Your suggestion is, in fact, accurate. There are new technologies available to do precise radiocarbon dating where we used to need 10 grams of charcoal to do a date. And that's if you hold out your hand and make a cup, that's about filling your hand with charcoal. It's a fair amount of charcoal. And so you could never date a rock art painting because you'd have to take all of it and you'd still not get a date. There's a new technique. It's called accelerator mass spectrometry, or AMS dating, that allows us to date 5 milligrams of charcoal carbon. So it's just a speck of it, and so we can now go to rock art paintings that are made of charcoal or that were drawn with charcoal, so black paintings basically, and pick off a tiny little bit and run an AMS date. And we did that in Tainter Cave. We actually dated one of those glyphs. It was 1,300 years old based on that AMS date. In doing that, you do damage the rock art to a minor extent, but it also costs $1,200 a date. So it's a fairly expensive proposition. But that is one of the new tools that is available to us to begin to build a chronology for rock art. And it's something that 50 years from now, we'll have done a lot more of that. We'll have a much greater understanding of how old these paintings are. Carvings, on the other hand, or petroglyphs that don't have organic pigment within them are at this point very difficult to date. We can look at things like weathering on the surface of the rock, and maybe there's new techniques that can come out to give us absolute dates on those. But right now, if it's a charcoal painting on a rock, we have the ability. It's just expensive to get a date for it.
Colored ones.
Thanks, Dick. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, not the colored ones. The ones in Larsen Cave, for example, are red paint, and that's red ochre, a red pigment. And unless that ochre is mixed with an animal ingredient like, fat or grease or something like that to create a paste, then, if that's in there, we might be able to date it.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
thanks, Dick.
Good luck.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Daniel in Rice Lake. Hi to you, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I've long wondered, when did the technology change in projectile points and arrowheads from tied on to hafts with indentations on the points and later glued with blood and tied with sinew, and is that an accurate clue to dating points?
Wow, the projectile point chronology that we have through the past 12,000 years, changes substantially from the first cultures 12,000 years ago to 5,000 years ago, where you get spear points that have notches, to about 2,500 years ago. There's a sudden change in projectile point shape where all of a sudden we don't find notches anymore, and the projectile points just have straight stems on them with no notches, and then the stems actually evolve into contracting stems, so they actually taper in. And when you look at those points, you have to wonder, how did those stay in the haft? And in fact, they're probably meant to come out of the haft. If they wanted them to stay in the haft, they would have kept the notches to tie them on and lash them on. So these are probably spear points that are meant to when you throw the spear and you hit the animal you're hunting, that the spear shaft may fall out and the point, the stone tip, would stay in the animal. And then as the animal tried to get away, continue maybe cutting and causing bleeding and things like that. That's a technological, shift that we see very widespread about 2,500 years ago. And then things get kind of interesting for the next 500 years, where we start to get notches again a little bit. And then about 500 A.D., or 700 AD, between that time period, the bow and arrow comes in, and all of a sudden we get very, very small stone-tipped points to fit onto a bow and arrow. And those initially start with notches, and later on they become unnotched again, and it's probably the same principle that the point is meant to come off of the haft.
Interesting. Thanks, Dan, for calling. Appreciate it. Phil and Sullivan, your turn now. Hi, Phil.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. Great show. I wanted to ask, I believe I heard that with, at the Gottschalk shelter there was an offering that was associated with the painting that was found in the floor below the painting that tied the art to the effigy mound culture and thereby tied the effigy mound culture to the modern Ho-Chunk culture or the historic Ho-Chunk culture because of this red horn depiction was part of their legend.
Right. Yep. Generally, that's the story. In the floor of the Gottschalk Rock Shelter, the archaeologist Bob Salzer, who excavated for a number of years, came up with a whole series of layers of occupation that were used, that cave was used for, and each layer had broken pottery and animal bones and things like that, and then some ritual items as well. And in one of the layers, they found, for example, a sandstone statue about 10 inches tall, and the face in the sandstone statue, it's of a human head, has painted lines on it and things like that. In some of the layers right below the painted panel on the wall of the cave, they found supposed drippings of the blobs of paint that actually spilled onto the floor, and then so they can utilize that to correlate which layer in the ground the paintings were actually, you know, correlate to when the paintings were done. And when they do radiocarbon dates of the charcoal in the floor deposits that have the paint blobs and look at the pottery that's found in that layer, it correlates to the effigy mound culture, it seems. Either that or the initial Mississippian culture, and there's not a lot of Mississippian pottery. Well, I don't think there's any in Gottschalk. So it looks like the paintings at Gottschalk may, in fact, date to the effigy mound time period. I, for some reason, I can't recall off the top of my head, but it's possible. It seems that Dr. Salzer may have gotten one of these AMS radiocarbon dates from Gottschall too, and that's about 1,000 years old, so I can't remember off the top of my head. And I should know that. But in any case, it looks like the paintings correlate to the effigy mound time period, and if the painted panel does in fact represent the story of the Red Horn legend, which is a Ho-Chunk story recorded in 1913, then you can make the argument that the Ho-Chunk story goes back 1,000 years when it was painted on the wall of this cave by effigy mound people. Therefore, the Ho-Chunk are connected to the effigy mound culture.
Interesting. Thanks, Phil. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. Email us at talk@wpr.org as well. And let's go to Jeremy in Edgerton. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I lived in Yak, Montana, which is right at the Canadian-Idaho border, and we have a wonderful, in the Kootenai River there was an island covered in rock art. And I have been photographing rock art for about 15 years all over the country, and I happen to live in Edgerton, Wisconsin, which has, of course, the Aslan mm-hmm. complex and wonderful effigy mounds. And I actually named my recording studio and company after Ashkelon just because it's such an interesting place. And it's just to walk into those areas, you really do get a sense of what people, you know, what has happened and what has transpired. And I just really like this show and just wanted to share that with you and just how neat that art really is.
Thanks for calling in. Ernie Bozart, I think you would agree that it is pretty neat.
Well, it is. It's fascinating. I mean, I have one of the best jobs in the world because you get to visit places in whether it's a mound group or walking into the state park at Aztalan or going into a cave and seeing rock art and discovering rock art. You get the sense of place, and it literally takes you back in time, and you just have to wonder, you know, about how these people, you know, stayed alive in Wisconsin winters and the floods we're having out here in the Driftless area and survived. and the world they lived in. You just get a very special sense of place, and then of course it turns to like, now how do we protect this stuff and how do we manage it?
Yeah, that's for sure. By the way, you're regional archaeologist with the Mississippi Valley Archaeology Center at UW-La Crosse. Tell us what that center is all about.
The Mississippi Valley Archaeology Center, or MVAC, has been at UW-La Crosse since 1982, so we're celebrating our 25th anniversary. We do a variety of things. Much of what we do is consulting or contract archaeology, so we'll work with, for example, the Department of Transportation when they're constructing a new road, then they're required by laws to hire archaeologists to make sure that there's not significant sites that are going to be destroyed by that road. So we're hired by agencies to do that sort of work. That's most of the work we do here. But then we do an awful lot of public outreach work where we have two educational people on staff who work with teachers to try to incorporate archaeology into the K-12 curriculum. I give talks all the time, as do other staff members here, to civic groups. And then at UWO, we also have the only undergraduate archaeology major in Wisconsin and only one of 9 or 10 in the country. So we work closely with the students going through that program, working with field schools and giving them applied experience in archaeology, generally with a Midwest focus, although we also have an MD in archaeology on the faculty here as well.
Let's go back to the phones and to Antoinette in Wausau. Antoinette, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good morning. I am from Illinois, and over 50 years ago, I have in my possession, I keep holding on to it and showing people, it's a pink Indian arrowhead, pink stone, mm-hmm. and we lived about 20 miles west of Chicago, and it's got that cut, you know, that it would stay in the animal, like you were saying, but I was wondering where I should, you know, have it appraised, or if the public could appreciate it instead of me having it.
Sure. Well, where are you located now?
Wausau, Wisconsin.
You're in Wausau. Okay, there's an archaeologist at the two-year school there named Ron Lippi. He's actually an Ecuadorian archaeologist, but he would you could take it right there and show him, and he might be able to identify its age. I don't know that Wausau has a place to donate to. There's not a museum or archaeological center. If Ron can't help you at Wausau, there are archaeologists. You could send me a digital picture of it. I can give you my email if you wish, and I can probably make a comment about what it's made out of and how old it is based on its shape. The best thing to do when you find artifacts, though, in terms of sharing it with the public, is to get those back to the area they came from.
I think so.
And so what I would recommend is to look for a place in northeastern Illinois, and there's lots of places down there. There's a place called the Tri-State, oh, am I going to get this right, the Archaeological Society, and there's some people at Beloit College who are actively involved in that society. It crosses the Wisconsin and southern Wisconsin and northern Illinois state border, and it's a group for people who are interested in archaeology and do collections and things like that. And if you send me an email, I can give you the contact information for the people there. That's probably the best place to start, and they could direct you to an institution that may wish to accept the artifact for public display or interpretation or analysis.
All right.
So you want my email address?
Yeah.
Okay, it's my last name without the T. So it's B as in boy, O, S as in Sam, Z as in zebra, H, A, R as in Robert, and D as in dog, dot, R-O-B-E, the first four letters of Robert, and then it's at.
Is R-O-B like in boy again?
Yes, R-O-B as in boy, and then E as in Ernie, and then at U-W. lax.edu. LAX as in x-ray.
EDU. Okay, super duper. Thanks
yeah,
a lot.
You bet.
Yeah. It is beautiful.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling and for your interest in sharing it with others. Appreciate it very much, Antoinette. Thank you. Linda in Boscobel, it's your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling.
Great. We're building an ark here in Boscobel to escape this rain.
I would imagine.
Actually, I'm in Boscobel this summer finishing a book about Jan Beaver, who was a part Native American, woman who came to the area in 1992 and then ended up being instrumental in resurrecting the Ghost Eagle Mounds of Muscadet and helping to get the land sold back to the tribe, to the Ho-Chunk Nation. She had a vision quest in New York State prior to coming to Wisconsin, in which she saw ghost birds flying across the sky, wingtip to wingtip. And she found that vision in the Ghost Eagle Mounds of Muscadet. She worked with the notes of T.H. Lewis, a surveyor in the 1880s, who surveyed extensively the earthen monuments in the eastern United States, very instrumental in getting attention brought to the notes, the survey notes of T.H. Lewis. Now that I've put in my plug, I'll thank you very much for your time. And another of her visions was to have a heritage corridor to reclaim all the ancient mounds along the riverway from Prairie du Sauk to Prairie du Chien. And there is public conversation now about that concept, and I think it would be an incredibly wonderful thing if it were to come to pass.
What do you think, Ernie?
Well, first of all, I met Jan Beaver, and she unfortunately passed away unexpectedly, way too early. A remarkable woman. The Ho-Chunk Bison Ranch it was an amazing story where the Ho-Chunk acquired a large piece of property on the Wisconsin River, but it had a nice mound group on it that was preserved along the river, and the Ho-Chunk are preserving that to this day. And then it's in Eagle Township in Richland County, and there were hundreds of mounds in that area that were plowed down, unfortunately. There's a number that remain, including the group on the Ho-Chunk Bison Ranch. And a lot of those mounds were mapped by Theodore Lewis, T.H. Lewis, in the 1880s, a remarkable individual, mapped something like 30,000 mounds in the upper Midwest in a 10-year time period. His story is actually the Wisconsin Archaeological Society publishes a journal called The Wisconsin Archaeologist, and within the past 3 months, there's an entire issue that was devoted to Theodore Lewis. If people are interested in reading more about Lewis, check the Wisconsin Archaeological Society online and look for their most recent editions, recent issue on Theodore Lewis, amazing individual. The corridor along the lower Wisconsin River is a very interesting concept. And quite honestly, it's coming to fruition. The Lower Wisconsin River Waterway, Mark Kupp with managing that, is, you know, they're finding and preserving mounds and trying to work with landowners as stewardship to preserve and create access and interpretive and ecotourism and heritage tourism, and so that's an ongoing story. Interestingly enough, Mark Kupp had a DNR forester go out this spring, and he was marking timber for in a timber sale area or a timber clearance area, and came across a mound group or two mounds in the woods, and they went back and checked the records, and they were mounds that Theodore Lewis had mapped in the 1880s, and so they relocated these things after 100 years, and now will preserve them. So it's fascinating stuff.
Thanks a lot for calling, Linda. Appreciate it very much. Nicholas in Coloma, your turn. Hi, Nick.
Yes, hello to both of you. In Rosha Cree State Park, there's a 300-foot tall rock formation. On one face of it, there are carvings, I believe, of initials and maybe names. My understanding, those were put in by early American white pioneers. Is that right?
That's correct. Rosha Cree State Park is unique geologically because it has that outlier sandstone bluff that is 300 feet tall in the middle of Old Glacial Lake, Wisconsin, and they created the state park around it. At the south end of that bluff is the panel where there are prehistoric Native American carvings and paintings. And that bluff, when you go to look at it, it's got the public interpretation panels there. That's the one that was vandalized a few years ago. But there are names carved right over the top of some of the paintings and the carvings. And they go back to the earliest one is 1845 or 48. There's a series from the 1860s. And in fact, There's indications that there was a Civil War regiment that was mustered in to go in 1861, and they camped at Rochecree, and they actually used that bluff as for target practice. So when you look at the panel, you'll see little ping holes in the sandstone from 1861 Civil War folks shooting into it.
Wow. Thanks a lot, Nick. Dick in Minocqua, hi to you.
Hi, good morning. I got a question for your guest. I drive a truck for a living, and I get up around Sturgeon Bay, and they're doing a highway project up there. And a little about a year ago or so, they're doing quite a bit of digging. And he said that through the La Crosse, they go in there and they go in and they look for artifacts. And I was just wondering if he was a part of that, or if he knows anything about that, or what they found, because it seemed to be pretty extensive. The amount of digs they were doing on that road right away before they actually did the construction of the road.
Right, right. Yeah, you're probably referring to the Highway 57 corridor reconstruction project from Green Bay up towards Sturgeon Bay. There was a classic example of DOT hiring archaeologists. It wasn't us at the Mississippi Valley Archaeology Center. They actually hired two groups out of Milwaukee. UW-Milwaukee does that kind of work, and then there's a group called the Great Lakes Archaeological Research Center, which then became affiliated with Marquette, and they changed their name to some extent. But they worked on those projects. They did the survey when they initially looked at the first routes to put the road, the new highway corridor up. They looked at a series of alternative possible routes. They surveyed those. They found lots of sites. DOT used that information to guide in refining and choosing the final route. Sites that could not be avoided were then excavated. So for the past 4 or 5 years, there's been archaeologists from Milwaukee up there actually excavating sites before the bulldozers came in and would destroy them through construction. They found, I wasn't directly involved, but they found sites that date back 10,000 years all the way up to sites that date back, Native American to about 400, 500 years ago. And then, in fact, there was early historic sites found as well. It was a town, Williamsburg or Williamston, I can't remember, but it's a town that burned down during the Peshtigo Fire when the flames leaped across Green Bay and onto the Door County side and became a ghost town, and they found remains of that. So,
very cool. And Ernie, I guess, we've talked about a lot of things relating to Native American art, and I want to get back just at the end here to this vandalization business, because people really need to be vigilant about this and take care and do their part to educate others.
Exactly. Yeah, it's all we can do is ask the public to participate and act as collective stewards. And that just involves becoming aware. And I think it's the key element is to try to educate the youth, because most of the time it's probably teenagers and young adults going into these caves. Like you and I would have done when we were 16, 17 years old, and just not knowing any better, going in there and exploring and doodling and unknowingly damaging the art. And we need to make sure that they're aware that there's 1,000-year-old paintings and carvings in these places that are irreplaceable, and to act as stewards for them.
Ernie, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Larry. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it very much. Ernie Bozart, regional archaeologist with the Mississippi Valley Archaeology Center at UW La Crosse, and he's the author of a book on deep cave rock art sites in southwest Wisconsin. It's called Deep Cave Rock Art in the Upper Mississippi Valley. It's published by Prairie Smoke Press. Interesting book. And he, along with Jim Thieler, have also published a book called 12 Millennia, The Archaeology of Wisconsin's Driftless Area. Ernie Bozart, real pleasure to have him with us. Coming up, we're going to take a look at making the best airfare purchasing decisions. I'm Larry Mueller. Keisha Mabra, our on-air producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.